It is the festival of festivals. And it has been so affirmed by God Himself. Incarnation after incarnation, when the Lord has appeared, He has again chosen this same date to perform His very special pastimes. So let me begin by first and foremost extending a very warm greeting and happy Diwali wishes to each one of you who have assembled here, and also on behalf of Srila Prabhupada and all the Vaishnavas, to extend a warm welcome to each one of you who have spared their valuable time to be present here today for this Sunday afternoon feast. We very often hear that Diwali, Dasera, and so many other occasions when they are celebrated, that the newspapers you generally read a festival which marks the victory of good over evil, right? Very often we hear this. But then after that one line, there's no further talk about this. We are not explained any further details about this. What is good and what is evil? So, today let us try to go a little deep into this subject matter and find out why is Diwali that festival where we consider it as a victory of good over evil, and in what way, what is that goodness which we want to invoke, and what is that evil which we want to get rid of? I sincerely seek the blessings of all the Vaishnavas before I proceed to say something. I would like to take up one verse from the Bhagavad Gita. We don't have it in writing here for the simple reason that it's a very common verse. I am sure most of you must be knowing it. The verse is Matra sparshamstu kaunteya Shitoshna sukha dukkhada Agama payino nityas Bharata. The translation goes like this. O son of Kunti, the non-permanent appearance of happiness and distress and their disappearance in due course are like the appearance and disappearance of winter and summer seasons. They arise from sense perception, O scion of Bharata. One must learn to tolerate them without being disturbed. This is the 14th verse from the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. And this immediately follows the most fundamental verse of the Bhagavad Gita. And that is Dehi Nosmen Yatha Dehi, in which Krishna explains to Arjun. Arjun has asked a simple question, or rather a very grave question, on the battlefield to Lord Sri Krishna, and he says that I cannot fight with my own grandfather, I cannot fight with my own spiritual master, I cannot fight with my own kith and kin. At such a cost, I don't want this kingdom. So, O Lord, I am in no mood to fight. And completely breaking down, he keeps down his bow, the Gandiva bow for which he is so famous. He just says, Gandivam sansrute hastat, means it is slipping down from my hand. Tvakchvaivam paridahyate, he says all my skin is burning, and so many descriptions are given. So he has become completely a nervous patient at that point of time, and he is unable to go further. And in answer, we would think that Krishna would try to pacify him. Oh no, you are a warrior, you should fight, or this or that, or some reasons. What is the profit? What is the loss? Some equations. No. On the contrary, Krishna is simply telling him, you are not the body, you are the soul. So the question is, for such a grave question, what is this answer? What is the connection that it has? How will it solve Arjuna's problem? By knowing that I am not this body, I am the soul. And even Prabhupada was accused by many of his critics that every now and then when you go to the ISKCON temple or the ISKCON meetings or the congregation and Prabhupada speaks, he repeats the same point again and again. How many times we have heard him say, you are not this body, you are the soul. And Prabhupada's answer was, but even after telling you, you still don't understand. So therefore it has to be repeated again and again for effect, because it has gone down so deep within our psyche, within our inner consciousness, to misidentify ourselves with this body which we are not, and to forget our true identity which is the soul. Therefore, Krishna is starting from A. He is starting from number one. He is starting from where it should begin. He goes down to the very basics and fundamentals of knowledge. Knowledge means to know. Today's education system has been so framed that after completing your school education, you enter college. And when you enter college, you would go for graduation, then you go for post-graduation, then you can go for master's or for PhD, and so many specialties, so many specializations. You get various certificates and various degrees. But you will be surprised to know, according to the scriptures, according to the Vedic Shastras, even a person decorated with maybe a string of 10 degrees, the Shastras say he is a man in ignorance, ajnana. Why? For the simple reason that what is real knowledge? Real knowledge is not to know the things of this world. Real knowledge is to know which you may not be able to see with your eyes. It is to know who is God. It is to know who are you. And it is to know your relationship with God, or in other words, what is the goal of your life. Now these subject matters are not taught in schools and colleges. So people pass out like products come out from a factory. They are churned out. They come with a stamp when things come from a factory. So they hold a certificate in their hand. That is their stamp that I am educated. But if you ask them some of the basic questions, they have no answers. And then they go about life wandering, pillar to post, like a cloud that is pushed about by the wind, and ultimately they have no fixed goal in life. And then you find educated people indulging in sinful and grievous activities. You also find people engaging in such heinous activities like terrorism. And they are educated. Terrorists are not uneducated. They are people who know to operate airplanes, they are people who know to operate computers, people who know to operate sophisticated machines. So they are highly qualified people. Some of them are doctors, lawyers, and so on and so forth. So what is the perversion of this education then due to? It is because of the lack of this basic knowledge. The basic knowledge of what is your true identity. Unless one knows that, one cannot really perform in life. Performing in life does not mean simply earning money and maintaining a family. Even without money, animals are able to maintain their family. And what to speak of only maintaining their family? They do so many activities which sometimes even surprise human beings. But then, so coming back to our basic question is now, this verse that we just spoke of, Matra Sparsham Stu Kaunteya, is immediately following the verse of Dehi Nosmin Yatha Dehi, which is giving the fundamental knowledge of the Bhagavad Gita. That is, in other words, another name for Bhagavad Gita is Science of the Soul. It actually teaches you who you really are, what is your true identity, and that you are not this body, you are the soul. And this science cannot be laboratorily verified. That is the beauty of it. It cannot be tested in a laboratory, because the soul can neither be caught in a microscope, in a telescope, in an X-ray film, or on the monitor of a TV screen, because it is beyond sense perception, or in other words, adokshaja. That is the word used to describe. And this knowledge can only come from one who knows authentically from the one who is the very creator himself. and nobody else is qualified to give this knowledge. And therefore, Krishna gives this knowledge. And until and unless we listen to him, we will be in ignorance, no matter how much qualified we may be, or how much of money we may be making, or how much of name, fame, beauty, strength, or any of the opulences we may possess of this world. But it will be fruitless, like a tree which may stand gloriously tall but bears no fruit. So what is this verse speaking about? It says that this world in which we live is a world of duality. Duality means opposites. It's a world of opposites. Matra sparsham su kaunteya shita ushna sukha dukha da. That means shita means cold and ushna means warm, winter, summer. So between winter and summer, we have to fluctuate. Between happiness and sorrow, we have to oscillate. This is our state of being. This is how we live in this world. And we have to tolerate all these things. There is no choice for us. So this verse is speaking that if you want to live in this material world, you have to learn to live between the opposites and the extremes. So there are two extremes, and in between there is a whole spectrum of shades of differences. So this is known as diversity. Diversity means variegated. Variegated that ends in duality. That means two extremes. So it's known as diversity. Now, there are so many flowers. They all are flowers, but they have different shapes, different sizes, different color, different aroma. And when all these flowers come together, they can be stringed together in a nice garland. Or they can be assembled in a nice bouquet. So Prabhupada explains that unity is strength. When they come together, though they may be of diversified nature, but together they present a beautiful picture. So this is known as unity in diversity. So this is what this verse is teaching us, that you may live in this world among opposing forces, among opposing demands that may be made in your life, but you know, you must know to harmonize and synthesize these things in your life. And when the opposites are harmonized, what is the result? It creates happiness. Like when so many flowers are stringed together, then what happens? You have a beautiful garland, and the garland serves a purpose, and it enhances the beauty of each flower. Similarly, in society, there are people who have individual qualities. There may be differences on the individual platform between human beings. But together, they come together as a society. And as a society, when they are united, they serve a purpose, a very important purpose. It is said, when a child is born, one mother and one father are required to give birth to a child. Then one family is required to rear the child. But to bring up the child, you need a whole village. You cannot bring up the child in isolation. It needs a whole society to grow in. And that is Prabhupada's great contribution. He has given us spiritual values. He has given us the teachings of Bhagavad Gita. He has given us the teachings of Srimad Bhagavatam. He has given us the teachings of Chaitanya Charitamrita and so many books like Ishopanishad and so many other books. And they are invaluable. And he has made it accessible to us by translating them into English, which is the language of common use. But how will you inculcate and receive these values, this knowledge? How are you going to do it? You can't take water. If I just give you water, I say, take this water. You'll say, give me a glass to hold it in. Give me a bottle in which I can hold it. You need a container to take the water. So, you need a society wherein the given values can be cultivated and given to those who come there. It is like a container. Just like you can't give liquid without a container, you can't give values without having a society which lives and practices those values. So that is why what Prabhupada has done to perpetuate this knowledge and this culture for generations to come, he created a whole society and named it as the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. That is his great genius, great stroke of genius that he has done. Otherwise, he could have given the message and after him, the book would have been closed and people would have forgotten him. But today, it is throbbing all over the world with life. This society of Krishna consciousness. It's actually growing, still in its growth, growing in many directions, in many places. So this is his great genius. What is the meaning of the word harmonizing? Harmonizing means to honor and respect each other, keeping a higher principle in the center. That is the meaning of harmonizing. In the family, there may be differences between the husband and wife, but the child is the cause for harmony because they have a common goal to bring up the child and give a nice future to the child. Similarly, in a corporate sector, when people come together to work, there will be so many differences in their individual lifestyles, their presentations, their way of thinking, and their way of functioning. But still, they come and be together. For what? So that they can earn profits. So this is the meaning of the word harmonizing. But then why is this diversity creating a division? That is one problem which we always notice. In the spectrum of human society, when we see there is so many varieties and so many variegatedness, but very often we find that diversity results in dissensions, results in differences, results in separatism, factions. So why is this happening? It is explained that it is because we have disconnected from our own self. That is the reason this is happening. This again goes back to the first verse which we did, that Matra Sparsham Sukamte, and before that Dehi Nosmi Nyata Dehi. Until and unless one knows that I am not this body, I am the soul, and this is my true nature, and if we stick to the identity of ourselves as this body, as the external features that we see, then divisions and dissensions are bound to be there. So until and unless we rise above that and see the go to the inner truth, we will never know it. So, and then there is this word yoga. Yoga, the meaning of the word yoga is to unite at a broader level the whole of humanity, otherwise to unite oneself with God. On the individual level, to unite oneself with God. Yunjate iti yoga. To connect with God. This is the meaning of the word yoga. So, to understand this aspect of connecting oneself to God, it is nicely explained that you cannot know God until and unless you have Guru. Guru, Sadhu, Shastra, it is explained, are the three supports that God has given to us by which we can grow in this world. So, one nice example was given. A person is suffering from short-sightedness. So he cannot see distant objects clearly. Right? So what does he do? He uses lens. And what is the purpose of that lens? To bring that distant object into sharp focus. And to give clear sight of that object. Exactly the same function is served by the Guru. The living entity in this world is suffering from short-sightedness, only concerned with the immediate needs, not understanding what is the long-term goal of life. So then, into that life of such a person, when a Guru enters, it is like holding a lens in front of those person's eyes. Then what is the result of that? He is then able to see in sharp focus that object which is at a distance, which normally is not able to see. So Guru then becomes a transparent medium, because the lens is transparent. And the purpose of that lens is to bring into focus that which is not normally visible or not visible because of one's diseased condition. We are all in a diseased condition in this world, and that is what we call normal. That is what we call as normal. Are you a normal human being? Means yes, I am diseased, I am affected by materialism. That is the meaning of normal. If not, then if you are spiritual, then you are abnormal. So this is the great function the Guru serves, of correcting one's vision. And so when one's vision is corrected in the society, then what is the result of that? That brings unity in the society. When everybody begins to understand this basic factor, when they start looking beyond their immediate external divisions, when they are able to rise above that, and they are going to go deep inside and understand what is their true nature and what is their connection to God, then what is the result of that? Then that society becomes a united society. There is unity, there is harmony in that place. And bhakti is the path of realizing one's true nature, harmonizing oneself, and it is explained, yoga means, ultimately it culminates in bhakti. We were speaking about yoga. Yoga means to connect. There are various different yogas are available, like you have karma yoga, jnana yoga, dhyana yoga. But ultimately everything has to culminate in bhakti yoga. Yoginam api sarvesham mad bhakti, mad gate antaratmana. Krishna explains in the 6th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. Out of all the processes of yoga, it is bhakti yoga which is the topmost. Because any other process of yoga has to ultimately culminate into bhakti. And bhakti means what? The meaning of the word bhakti is devotional service. This is how Prabhupada translates bhakti. Bhakti means devotional service. To serve in devotion. Devoted to whom? To the Supreme Lord, to God. He is the object of our devotion, and the activity that is one does in bhakti is to serve Him. So, and service has an integrated connection with love. Love and service are interrelated. That is the beauty. Wherever there is love, service follows naturally. If you love somebody, you will naturally serve that person. And the classic example of this is a mother. Mother loves the child and she serves the child selflessly. She doesn't say in the middle of the night when the child gets up, "Sorry, this is not the contracted time to serve you. Up to 10 o'clock in the night I am available. Now it is my time to sleep." She doesn't say that. At any given time, she serves the child. Because that service is born out of love. That is the nature of love. Love means to become selfless. It's not that you're doing it for something in return. When people work, it is for some gain in return. That is the difference between love, work and service. So therefore, bhakti is defined as devotional service. Service means to do selflessly out of love. So bhakti is the path of realizing that true love. The love which is reposed in the heart of every living entity towards God, who is the unifying factor. Because inherently we are all His parts and parcels, inseparable from Him. Mamai vamsho jiva loke jiva bhuta sanatana mana shrishthani indriyani sthane prakriti karshati. It's very nicely explained in the Bhagavad Gita. That every living entity is an inherent part and parcel of the Supreme Lord. Forget it being a human being, even a mosquito, even a microorganism. Even within that microorganism, there is a soul. So this is the nature of the soul. And the nature of the soul is to love and to be loved. So therefore, bhakti is love for the Supreme Lord. and to engage in devotional service for the Supreme Lord. That is bhakti. Divine love for Krishna is dormant in every heart, and when it awakens, the jiva wants to please Krishna at the cost of one's own happiness. This is the test whether that love is true. It's not that I will please you so long as it pleases me. No. Even at the cost of one's own happiness, when one is ready to extend oneself and please the Lord, that is the test that one's love for God is genuine, that it is matured. It is maturity of love. Love for God. And seva means unconditional service. It is an expression of our love, originally for Krishna, but Krishna is all encompassing. And therefore, when one loves Krishna, automatically one naturally loves every living entity. That is the beauty of loving Krishna. You automatically love every living entity without making a separate endeavor to do that, because Krishna is the embodiment of the whole. When the part, that is the individual, meets the whole, that is Krishna, then when the part meets the whole, it reaches the goal. This is the simple understanding. Bhaktivinoda Thakur has said, proof of love for Krishna is that one develops compassion for all living entities. And if wherever you see the compassion in the heart of an individual, you can understand, here is a person who really loves God. Another example is given to explain this concept of tolerance, which is explained in this verse that we are dealing with today. Matra sparshamstu kaunteya shitoshna sukha dukkada agama apayino nityaha tams titikshasva bharata. The word titikshasva means to tolerate. So in this world of duality, when you are living between the opposites, it is inevitable for you to learn to tolerate. So we have to cultivate this quality of tolerance in us. And to explain this tolerance, how to cultivate this tolerance in us, a very beautiful example is given. If you take a pencil and draw a line, but now it's not so simple, but imagine this line is going to infinity. We can draw a line on a notebook, on a piece of paper, on a table, but now imagine this line is going to infinity, unending, but it is a straight line which is going, and there is a dot on this line, and that dot is your present lifespan. So your present lifespan is a dot on a line which extends to infinity both sides. If you understand this, then whatever problems come in your life, you will not be disturbed, because you understand how insignificant is this one span of life and how extended is one's true life. That means we have to develop the quality to see beyond, before birth and after death. The soul exists even before we are born, and the soul will continue to exist even after we die. So the present lifespan is what unfortunately we all focus on, because that is our bodily concept. We are so wedded to the bodily concept that we think that our life extends from birth to death, but actually life extends beyond both birth and death. And if you understand that concept, understanding of the true soul, of the true nature, then the small problems of life, of course they may not be small, but the problems of life will become small. If you don't see them in this context, then the problems will loom large and it will consume you, and you will not be able to deal with them. And then people go to a psychiatrist and the psychiatrist goes mad. That is the problem. Because he has to deal with so many mad people. And then it is explained that even if you always succeed in life, what will happen? Supposing you always succeed in life, what will happen? You will be bored of success. That is why duality is necessary. Success and failure are the opposite ends. Until and unless you taste failure, you will not be able to appreciate success. Another example is given, which is very graphic. Supposing you are given something to eat, lunch plate. Okay, everything is spread out on the lunch plate, and everything is sweet. Everything is sweet. How would you enjoy that lunch? No salt, no chilies, no pepper. Would you enjoy that lunch? So then that we understand. The same thing we have to apply in our life also. If things are always favorable, if you always succeed, if everything goes according to your plan all the time, then that life would become a very boring one. So it is by Krishna's arrangement that he has given us the opposites. He has put us into this duality. And it is on our part, what we have to learn to do is to deal with this duality, with this kind of a knowledge. When two people don't get along, they have issues and cannot forgive each other. It's a very common thing which all of us have experienced in our life. We may be one of them. Two people not getting along, one is us, okay? One is the other person. To bring back the relation to one of affection and not merely to a position of ceasefire. Otherwise it is that, okay, lena dena nahi, but then again that kind of, you know, cold war is going on between the two. No. It has to come back to one of affection. One has to come together on a higher platform of service to God. That is the solution to the problems of life. This is how the problems of life can be solved in a real way. So therefore, without bringing God into the picture, we really don't have proper solutions to our everyday problems. So God is not just a figment of imagination. God is not something, a subject of philosophy, but God is somebody who is very much integrated into our life and a necessity for us to live a sane life. When there is crisis in people's lives, what happens? Actually, you can chant very attentively at that point of time. When there is no crisis, your chanting is very casual. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram. You are very comfortable chanting. But then your heart is not in your chanting. But when there is a crisis, there is a court case tomorrow, and the verdict can go either in your favor or in favor of the other person. And if you lose everything. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. God, where are you? I am here. Completely focused. And there is full absorption. So crisis also has a role to play in our life. It can help you, bring you back in sharp focus. And Prabhupada has said, show me your love. He says that, show your love for me by how you cooperate with each other. So within this society, this is one thing Prabhupada has given. But we are part of the larger human society. We are also part of the ISKCON society. So here we have to cooperate with the devotees. But when you go outside the society of ISKCON, you are still part of the larger society. It is not that you exist only in ISKCON. Outside ISKCON, you don't have an existence. So over there, we have to apply this. We have to understand. All conflicts are actually an opportunity to grow spiritually. This is a very important point we have to note. Whenever there is a conflict, it is an opportunity to grow spiritually. Somebody very nicely said, actually there is another way of understanding the word no. N-O. N-O means new opportunity. It's a new opportunity. When somebody says you, tells you no, it is not that the door is shut. It is that some other door is going to open. But we are always looking for change. The problem is, we want the other person to change. Actually, change has to begin from oneself. You cannot productively change others until and unless you change yourself. When you come inside Bombay Airport, when you enter the arrival lounge, what do you see that big caption there? You be the change that you want to see in others. So this is what this verse is teaching us. You should learn to tolerate the shortcomings of others Learn to tolerate your own shortcomings, but be determined to bring about a change in you to overcome these shortcomings. Diversities actually create an urgency to go deeper and higher in our values and in our sadhana. They have a very important role to play. There is a nice shloka in the Bhagavad Gita which says, Daivi esha hi gunamai mama maya duratyaya mame vaye prapadyante maya yetam tarantite. The meaning of this is, even this material creation and this so-called illusion is also Lord's own potency and power. Maya, the illusory potency of the Lord. He says, this is my own energy and therefore it is very, very powerful. So we cannot win over this illusory potency of the Lord on our own strength. Mameva ye prapadyante, one who surrenders to me, he alone can cross over this. So therefore we should remember, even to solve the daily problems of our life, until and unless we learn to take shelter of the Lord Krishna, we will not be able to do that in an effective way. And only when you take shelter of the Lord, you can access the grace of the Lord. Then all the diversities can be explained, can be experienced as gifts of Lord. Now we are going to take upon the story of Ramayana to understand, because Ramayana is related to Diwali. And today that will bring us back to this. So let us try to understand all this theory that we just discussed in relation to the story of Ramayana and the events of Ramayana as they unfold themselves. When Bharat and Shatrughan were away, Ram was coronated as the prince regent. That means the one who will become the king after the present king expires. And Mantara, who is the assistant of Kaikeyi and the mother of Bharat. Kaikeyi is the mother of Bharat. So, she begins to instigate Kaikeyi. Mantara begins to instigate. Why does she do that? Because Kaikeyi is the favorite queen of Dasharath and he is showering lot of goodies on her. And naturally, because Mantara is her personal assistant, she gets a lot of cream from Kaikeyi. Now what is happening is, she foresees a danger to her sense gratification. When Ram will be crowned as the king, then what will happen? Kaushalya will become the favorite queen of Dasharath. And what will happen? Kaikeyi will fade into the background. And Mantara, who is a hunchback, a deformed personality, by on herself, she cannot actually claim any benefits. So she is dependent on Kaikeyi. So now, for her selfish ends, she is instigating Kaikeyi and telling her that you should actually make Ram go to exile and get Bharat crowned as the king. So the power of her envy convinced Kaikeyi to exile Ram and make Bharat the king. It is explained, Kaikeyi is a very good lady. She is a favorite queen of the Lord and she actually loved Ram. But because of bad association, she was influenced. So this is the power of association which we have to take note in our lives. We have to always observe with whom are we associating. These are some of the teachings that unfold as you come read Ramayana. And it is given in a nice story form, so you can actually appreciate graphically. But then Lord Ram accepted this verdict in a very simple way. For him it was not a problem at all. So he was willing to make that sacrifice. He did not say, well, when my name has been given as the prince, why should now I be, you know, told to go to the forest? He says, if that is the order of my father, I will do that. No second thoughts. Then Bharat was actually horrified because of this. And then ultimately he goes and meets Ram at Chitrakoot, persuading Ram to come back. And that conversation between Lord Ram and Bharat at Chitrakoot is actually an example of two people who have matured in their love discussing with each other. Both of them are telling, I don't want to become the king, you become the king. That is the beauty. And they are telling it sincerely, not artificially. It is not that for the headlines of the newspaper he says, and then secretly he says, ensure that I become the king. No. Sincerely, they mean it when they say that. Then, what did Bharat do? Ultimately, he accepted the will of his elder brother. He went to Ayodhya, but he did not live in Ayodhya. He lived in a place outside Ayodhya, which is known as Nandigram. And over there, he lived in a condition which would be more humbler than the condition in which Ram would live in exile in the forest. So he also wore tree bark. He also ate roots and shoots. And actually he dug a small hole in the ground and he lived below the surface of the earth. He said, I will not sit on the surface because my brother is walking on the surface. So I will take a position lower than that. He took the paduka of Lord Ram and he enthroned them as the king. And he would worship the paduka every day, report to the paduka every day the matters of the kingdom and take instructions and orders from the paduka. The inspiration that he would get after giving the reports, and based on that he would perform his activities. So Bharat is giving an example of how to perform one's duty without being attached to the privileges that duty, that position gives you. He is giving an example. He is not taking any of the privilege of a king, but at the same time he is discharging the duties of a king very perfectly. That is his greatness. So this is preaching by example, and because Bharat Maharaj did that, all his ministers, all his courtiers, they also led a very simple life. In fact, the entire Ayodhya became like a deserted town when Lord Ram left the city. When the soul leaves the body, what happens to the body? It is a dead body. Ayodhya was living like that. It was as though the life had gone out of Ayodhya. So problems in this world are created by our egos and also by the ego of others around us. Ravan was one such person with inflated ego, was an egoistic person. He was a scholar and he was wealthy. But with all his scholarship, what he was able to do? He convinced himself and the others that he is the most pious person. That is what he was able to convince people. This is what it is said, that one's ego can become blinding. He became blinded to the truth. But with all this wealth and with all this power, he was still unhappy. Why? Because he wanted Sita. He was not able to conquer his own senses. Sense control is a very important aspect of spiritual development. So that is exactly what we see in the world today. People are materially growing affluent, but they are not growing spiritually because their senses are not in control. So he was unhappy, he wanted Sita, his senses were not in control. And love is about experiencing true wealth within ourselves and expressing it externally. This is the meaning of the word love. One has to actually go inside our own self and experience the true wealth which lies within each one of us. Otherwise, if you do not experience it, then what happens? That is what we are seeing in the world today. You want to go out and accumulate wealth externally. And the more you have, the more you want. This is material disease. The more you have, the more you want. And there is a word in Sanskrit which will describe this very nicely. It is known as prapancha. It is unending. The more you have, the more you want. It is like trying to catch the horizon. If you stand, you see the sky is touching the ground at a distance. So you decide how many kilometers from here. Use the binoculars and view it. Well, somebody told me it is 20 kilometers. So you take a jeep and go 20 kilometers. And what happens? Can you touch the sky? No. Again you find 20 kilometers further, the sky is touching the ground. So this is known as trying to chase the horizon. This is how people are chasing their dreams in this world. They are never satiated, no matter what they have. They want more, they want more. They are going on chasing. Now, as soon as one dream is complete, another dream comes in front of them. And they want to satisfy that. And Hanuman is a character who was a brahmachari. All he wanted is to serve the Lord, was willing to give his life and energies to get Sita back to Ram. So Hanuman was a brahmachari. All he wanted is to serve. He was willing to give his life and energies to get Sita back. He had no possessions. He was not a mercenary. He was a great fighter, but he was not a mercenary. He was not fighting for money. He was not greedy for the wealth of Lanka. Not at all. His only aspiration was to see Ram and Sita happy together. This was Hanuman's aim. He jumped across an ocean, he disguised himself, and he fought mystical warriors, because the kind of people who opposed Hanuman were not ordinary people. There was one Rakshasi. She had the power of bringing a person down just by holding his shadow. So when Hanuman was flying, she held his shadow and he could not fly further. He had to come down. Then he had to give a fight to her. So there were many such mystical warriors on the path. And he had to fight each one of them. Then to overcome another demoness, she went on opening her mouth and Hanuman became bigger and bigger and bigger. She opened her mouth wider and wider and wider to swallow him. No matter how big he became, she opened her mouth wider. Then he became tiny as a mosquito. He went into her mouth and came back. And then she was wondering, where is Hanuman? So he told her, see, you wanted to swallow me, you have done it. I have gone inside and I have come back. So then she prostrated in front of Hanuman. And she said, you are very intelligent. And she also gave him the forecast. She said, the day when I meet such a personality, I know the end of Lanka is going to come. So she was one of the demoness who was guarding Lanka. So he jumped across an ocean, he went into Lanka, and then he became tiny. But when he went into Lanka, what did he see? He saw fantastic wealth over there. Fantastic wealth. It was not something that you can imagine from today's standards. We are talking about something that happened in Treta Yuga. We are in Kali Yuga. In Kali Yuga, everything is diminished. People used to eat in golden plates and they used to cook in golden vessels. Can you imagine that? That was the standard in Satya Yuga. And in Treta Yuga, it was in silver vessels and silver pots they used to do everything. And today, we are using stainless steel, and forget that, we have come to plastic. So we are degrading faster. But even though he saw so much of riches strewn all across Lanka in his search for Sita, he was not attracted by any of these things. He did not think, this pearl is very nice. Dalo kise me. He never did those kind of things. Because he was fixed in his goal. His vision was very clear. He was searching for Sita. And he was not distracted by any of these things. He only looked for Sita. He did not pocket anything. And when he met her, what did he do? He gave her Lord Ram's ring. And he told her, I am a messenger and I have come, got this message from Lord Ram. And then Mother Sita gave him her message. And she said, you give my message to Lord Ram. So he said, yes, I am your servant. I will carry your message. So his duty was complete. The purpose for which he had come to Lanka was over. Now, he said, job done. Now let's enjoy. Thoda sa maja kar le. So what was his enjoyment? He ravaged the entire Ashok Vatika. He was a monkey. So what does monkey do? Oh, fool, he will not take the smell of a flower. He will crumple it. So here was a beautiful garden. So he started ravaging the entire Ashok Vatika. But what was his intention? He did it with a plan. He said, if I do this, if I create great amount of destruction over here, the guards will come and capture me. And ultimately, they will take me to Ravan. So then I will be able to come face to face with Ravan. That was his plan, game plan. So ultimately it happened. He got captured and he came face to face with Ravan. For a devotee who is in a transcendental position, honor and dishonor do not affect him. Hanuman was not feeling dishonored when he was captured, because he was acting to a plan and he wanted to get captured. But he is doing it for a higher purpose. This is what we should always remember. This is what the teaching of Bhagavad Gita is. Again and again this point is being brought up. If you do something, for what are you doing it? That determines the motivation for which you are doing it. That determines the real quality of that work that person is doing. When you are deep in a river, actually what happens is, the current does not affect a person who is deep inside a river. You see, the current of the river may be very swift, but you will find one small fish easily going from one end of the river to the other end, from one bank to the other. Easily it swims across. One is, it has taken shelter of the river. Second thing is, it is going very deep. So when it's going very deep, whatever is happening on the surface, on the outer level, does not affect. Similarly, in our life, spiritually, we have to go deep. Then what happens? The material conditions of our life, which are bound to act upon us, will be on the surface level. When a fish is deep in the ocean, there may be a storm raging on the surface. The waves may be rising 10 feet high. But what is happening to that fish? Absolutely secure, absolutely safe, no problem. So this is how spirituality, by taking spirituality in a deep way, one can transcend the material problems of one's day-to-day living. So one should not be shallow, one should become deep. It does not matter how much knowledge, how much beauty one has. They are only on the surface level. Now Hanuman, he came face to face with Ravan. And what did he do? He condemned Ravan as a coward. Kayaretu. Publicly, in front of everybody, in front of his generals, in front of his wives, in front of his courtiers, he openly blasphemed him actually. You know, not, blaspheme is not the word for Ravan, but he condemned him. Ravan was enraged. And that was exactly what Hanuman wanted. So he said, kill this monkey. But Vibhishan was there to give him sane advice, his brother, in the court. And he said, no, he is a messenger of Lord Ram, you cannot kill him. So he thought, monkeys are very proud of their tails. So he ordered his soldiers, he said, catch hold of his tail and douse it nicely in inflammable substances like kerosene, petrol, and put it on fire. Then this monkey is going to suffer. So then I am not killing him, but then punishing him. So Hanuman accepted that dishonor and pain as an opportunity to serve Ram. This is the beauty of a devotee. whatever obstacles comes in one's path, he utilizes that in the service of the Lord. He set with his tail the entire Lanka on fire. That is what Hanuman did. He slipped out of the ropes in which he was bound and he jumped to the top of the palace and set the entire palace on fire, and he went to the neighboring monuments and all the neighboring structures, and actually eventually the whole of Lanka was burning. Here there is a lesson for us. It's explained, actually Ravana's fire of envy and enmity towards Lord Ram was actually burning his own wealth. This is what happens anyway in our own life. If you hold envy or enmity towards others more than doing harm to that person, your envy or your enmity to that person which actually destroy you first. That is what we have to understand. So this is how in Ramayana various episodes are teaching us various lessons. He could have come back undetected. Actually, Hanuman could have come back undetected. Just as he became so tiny, he could have become tiny and he could have come back. But he deliberately chose to do this, to give a powerful message to Ravan. He gave him a warning and he also carried the message of Lord Ram. I don't want a war with you. Just return Sita. I am ready to pardon you. This was Ram's generous offer to him. But Ravan didn't take heed of that. But then what he did was, ravaging, was simply out of love for Lord Ram. He was doing it as a service. So it is explained, anger can be thus utilized properly in the service of the Lord. Hanuman was very angry. Naturally, you are not going to burn a palace by telling, okay, so nice of you, let me burn you. It doesn't happen like that. He was really angry, so he burnt it. He damaged it. Then when Hanuman came back, as a reward, what did Lord Ram do? He embraced Hanuman. And Hanuman was supremely happy. It is explained, what is true wealth? Ram did not give Hanuman Kohinoor diamond or any such great opulence of this world. He simply embraced him. If you want to know how rich you are, find how many things you have that money cannot buy. You can actually take a stock and inventory of such things. Real wealth is the inner treasure. Money cannot buy two things for certain. That is, money cannot buy love, money cannot buy grace. These two things cannot be purchased with money. And there is a long list. Many of you must have read it on the internet. You can buy a bed with money, but not sleep. You can buy food with money, but not hunger. Like that, there are so many examples given. So, what is the true wealth of life? To have those things in your life which money cannot buy. How many of us have Lord Ram's embrace? So what is Hanuman's wealth? You can estimate from that. The wealthiest person from those standards, isn't it? Then after killing Ravan, what did Lord Ram do? He enthroned Vibhishan. And Vibhishan accepted that throne only as a service. Vibhishan was not attached to the throne. And this is another beauty which we have to notice. These great kings in the past, their conquering was not to aggrandize wealth, not to take over the wealth of those people. That was not the meaning of conquering. It was to set right dysfunctions in the society. Ravan was a person who was actually spreading adharma. He was not giving people the right direction. He was not guiding his subjects in the right path. He was not taking them towards God consciousness. Rather, he was feasting them on sense gratification. That is what he was doing. and that is not in the good interest of the living entity. So here is Ram, he is coming into Lanka. Of course, he is retrieving Sita. And after having conquered Lanka, he didn't think this is a wonderful country, it has got so much of riches. Cannot imagine how much of wealth is lying over here. Let me keep it as my territory. No. He is just taking his younger brother Vibhishan, putting him as the king and telling him, now you take over and you run. He is only ensuring that the next king who succeeds will be one who will follow proper dharma, proper etiquette, proper path, and he will guide people on the right line. So this is how the ancient kings were actually subjugating people for their own good and not for one's selfishness. Then he told Hanuman, it is time for me to return to Ayodhya now, because I have now enthroned Vibhishan as the king, and now it's time for me to go back to Ayodhya. And if Bharat wants to continue, he says, he is telling Hanuman, I will not take over. Let Bharat continue as the king if he so wants to, I don't want to take over. So he is giving a specific function to Lord Hanuman, to Hanumanji. He is telling Hanuman, you go and see for yourself what is the reaction of Bharat. If you find the smallest trace that he is attached to his position, to his throne, then I am not going to come there and disturb him. Only if the other danger is going to happen, that is, Bharat has given a promise, if you don't come back after the 14 years are over, even for a moment if you are delayed, I will end my life. He doesn't want that to happen. He wants to protect Bharat and all the citizens of Ayodhya. And when Bharat does that, so many citizens would give up their life. So he wanted to protect them. So he is going back. He is again fulfilling his duties. He is not going back as a hero. He is just going back to serve the people of Ayodhya. So even in the lives of great personalities, people can get attached to their service and their positions. So that is what is being shown here. So Ram is testing Bharat, that for 14 years he has been ruling the kingdom. After 14 years he might have got attached to the position. So let me first verify that. And only Hanuman was a person who was capable of testing it, because he was a matured devotee. He was a matured person. He could know that. So he entrusted that job to the right person. He was pure and he could detect it. So if Bharat was attached to remain as king and Bharat had that wealth of love for Ram, and Hanuman could notice that. Bharat also was a very wealthy person from those standards. He had the true love for Lord Ram. And when Hanuman saw that, he actually embraced him. In the presence of Bharat, and both Hanuman and Bharat, they embraced each other. Hanuman is bringing the news to Ram, to Bharat, that Lord Ram is coming. So Ramayana is the story of real wealth, actually. This is what we should understand. It is the story of unity in diversity. We cannot imitate these great souls, but we should imbibe these principles which they have in our life and make that change within ourselves. I would actually little bit like to go back to one aspect which I have not touched upon, and that's a very nice aspect. And that is the coronation of Lord Ram. Because when Lord comes back to Ayodhya, what happens at that point of time? So this is Lord Ram returning to Ayodhya. So before that, a few events are taking place which are highly instructive and which is very nice to imbibe on a day like Diwali. Because what is Diwali after all? It is the day when Lord Ram is returning to Ayodhya. And the spontaneous love that is bursting out from people's hearts and expressing itself, the external expression of that love is they are lighting lamps, they are bursting firecrackers, they are decorating their homes, they are illuminating their residences, they are illuminating their city, they are distributing sweets, they are singing songs, they are making merry. This is an expression of their love for the Supreme Lord. And so on this day, we have to take this spirit into our heart. We have to invite the Lord into our heart. And all these things that we do for Diwali should not be a ritual. From ritual, we have to go spiritual. That is the whole point. That is why we have to understand that all these customs and etiquettes which have been made, they are rooted in the individual living entity's love for God. And until and unless you keep that in sight, then what happens? It remains as an empty ritual. And over a period of time, people start questioning, why should I do this and why should I do that? Without knowing the essence. Okay? So here, I would like a little time for this aspect. Lord Ram killed Ravan and Vibhishan was coronated as the king of the Rakshasa dynasty. The peace formula is to accept the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna or Lord Ramchandra, as the proprietor of everything and utilize everything for his pleasure. And Vibhishan offered everything to Ram. He said, my kingdom is also yours. Actually, Ravan had told Kubera's Pushpaka Viman, you know, that Pushpaka it is known as, the airplane. A little bit about this airplane. Today we have airplanes. What is the biggest airplane we have? Airbus? What is the detail? 380 passengers it can hold. Now, let us see what is Pushpaka Viman. Pushpaka Viman did not need a runway to take off. You only have to wish and it will rise in the air. It does not need air traffic control. Okay? And another aspect of Pushpaka Viman is it held the entire Ram Darbar inside that. Ram had conquered, now his entire entourage was with him, Sita was there, Lakshman was there, Hanuman was there, Vibhishan was there. That is only a small part. The bigger part is still to come. The entire monkey dynasty army was there. And you know how is that? How much is that? It's mind-boggling. To be honest, I have not done my homework on that. But when I was reading this book, Ramayana, actually I went sometime back to one school in Worli. There is a school for the Japanese embassy. So they have these Japanese children there, and it's a small kind of a school, but a very high class school. And there they have private tutors and they have a small class, just 7 or 8 students will be in a class. So they asked me to narrate some part of Ramayana, which I did for them, and explain the significance of Nasik, the place where Shurpanakha's nose was cut and thrown. So Nasika, that is why it is known as Nasik. So all these points were being explained and spoke a little about Ramayana. And then these children are very bright. So then they said, okay, you can ask questions. So one child asked me a question, how many monkey soldiers were there in Lord Ram's army? So I just said, well, millions and millions of them were there. But when I came back and I was speaking to one brahmachari in the temple, he said, no, you have wasted a wonderful opportunity. Actually, a whole system of mathematics has been developed to count the monkey soldiers in Ram's army. So, I don't know the words correctly. That's why I said I have not done my homework on that. But there are words, such words, which crore is nothing. Crore is probably just like counting one. And from there it goes on to such a huge, vast quantity, mind-boggling quantity. So many monkey soldiers were there in Lord Ram's army. And now, Lord Ram told, they have helped me to get Sita back. So, I want to give a ride to all of them on the Pushpaka Viman. So it is not like when you go to the airport, how many kilos does your baggage weigh? If you are having 5 kilos more, you have to pay for excess luggage. There is no such problem or constraint for Pushpaka Viman. Ram said, he told Vibhishan, I want to take all of them. He said, oh, yes, my lord, whatever you want. So this entire monkey army climbed on Pushpaka Viman. And there were lakes, there were forests, because monkeys need trees, they can't sit. They don't sit on seats, they sit on trees. So there was a whole forest inside the Pushpaka Viman. Can you imagine now that? And this was Kubera's airplane. And this was stolen by Ravan and he kept it with himself. Kubera was his own brother actually. So he stole it and he kept it with himself. This is the mentality of a lusty person, a greedy person. He wants to possess everything. He wants to hold it to himself. And Lord Ram was utilizing this in the service of those who served him. And with this Pushpaka Viman, he went to Ayodhya. And once he returned to Ayodhya, he told the Pushpaka, "You go back to Kubera now." Because Ravan stole it from Kubera, so he is returning it to the original owner. This is the quality of a great person. He did not think, "I have won a victory over Ravan. Now it was Ravan's property. Now it becomes my property." No. Let it go back to the original owner. As promised, he stopped at Prayag at Bharadwaj Muni's ashram. And from the confluence, he sent Hanuman. That part we already described. And so Hanuman went and he checked with Bharat. And he found that he was an embodiment of humility. And what did he see? That Bharat was actually worshipping Lord Ram's sandals at Ayodhya. And 14 years he remained at Nandigram, which all these things we already discussed. He wore tree bark, he ate shoots and roots. And now Hanuman is bringing the message to Bharat. Lord Ram is now coming back to Ayodhya. And it is explained in a poetry form how he explains this. Because he knows that Bharat is so anxious and eager that even the mention of the word Ram would make him faint. What happened to my Ram? Is he going to come? Is he not going to come? So he says, has come Lord Ram. He doesn't say Lord Ram has come. First he says, has come. Then he says, Lord Ram. So that it is very clear that Ram has come. So then he knows that yes, he is coming. So then he will be composed. That is how he brings the message. And he says, today Ram will come to meet you. Hanuman noticed that Bharat was completely emaciated. His hairs were matted and he was suffering from separation from Lord Sri Ram, and so were the residents of Ayodhya. They all had performed severe tapasya and they were just patiently waiting for Lord Ram to enter. And as Lord Ram's Pushpaka Viman started descending down, Lord Ram and Mother Sita were shining like jewels on the front portion of that Pushpaka Viman, and fanning them were Vibhishan and Hanuman. Vibhishan and Lakshman were fanning both of them. And Hanuman was seated in... Hanuman was here. I mean, he was already with Bharat. And this beautiful sight was beholden by Bharat and the entire population of Ayodhya who had assembled there eagerly waiting for Lord Ram to come. It was a great sight. It was a feast for their eyes. For whom, for long, 14 long years, they had living in separation. And when he heard that Ram is coming, he started shedding tears of joy and he became speechless. And he started asking Hanuman about Lord Ram's various pastimes when he was in the forest. And then Hanuman spoke the entire Ramayana, starting from the point of Chitrakoot, where Bharat left Lord Ram. From that point he started. Bharat came back to Ayodhya to rule, and Lord Ram then went and crossed the Ganges and went over into the forest of Dandakaranya, and then how he there, came across Ravan and so many other things. This entire episode he narrated. And Bharat ordered a royal reception for Lord Ram. And that royal reception is actually Diwali. The way in which the people of Ayodhya receive Lord Ram, that is actually the celebration of Diwali. And you just see spontaneously how people are decorating their homes, how lamps are lit outside every house, how people come in fine garments, how they distribute sweets, what a gay and festive atmosphere is created all around, what a joyous atmosphere. This is the beauty of the Lord's transcendental pastimes and activities. When we perform something, after our lifetime, the whole thing is forgotten. But when the Lord performs something, it is embedded in the consciousness of all the living entities, and that celebration continues generations after generations, ages after ages. Yugabhi paryantam, that means till so many yugas pass, but these celebrations never stop. Hanuman sighted the Pushpaka first and he announced Lord Ram's return. Bharat fell down on sighting that Pushpaka Viman like a rod. That is how the word Dandavat has come into word. Dandavat means to fall down like a rod. He was so much absorbed in the ecstasy of seeing Lord Ram that he became like a rod. He just fell down like that. And while Lord Ram was descending at Nandigram, the Pushpaka touched down. Shatrughan and Bharat, they both approached in ecstasy. Just when Lord Ram emerged, Bharat fell down. He became unconscious. He went and lifted him and embraced. And all the citizens became very, very joyful. They started weeping tears of joy and their bodies started trembling. Lakshman and Shatrughan embraced each other. Reunion of Kaushalya and Sumitra, they also came. They embraced Sita. And then one question can be answered at this point of time, because generally women used to give up their life when their husbands pass away. But why did Kaushalya and Sumitra and the other queens, Kaikeyi also, remain alive? Because they knew that Ram would come back and they have to be there at that point of time. And the whole idea was to give pleasure to Lord Ram. Otherwise he would feel so desolate without them. So this is the goal of all Vedic activities. The goal of all Vedic activities is to give pleasure to the Supreme Lord. Kaikeyi too was there. She was already forgiven at Chitrakoot by Lord Ram. He was not holding any grudge against her. And now here her natural attraction for Lord Ram again surfaced in her heart. She went and embraced him. Vasishtha was there and all the others offered their blessings. Bharat said, I was like a crow. And now he said, I was actually trying to perform the duties of a swan. Lord Ram is a swan and I am like a crow. In the absence of the swan, like a crow I was serving, trying to perform the duties of a swan. But now Lord Ram, that you have come back, you please take over. And so he very gracefully handed over the kingdom to Lord Ram. Then they all had their bath, a ceremonial bath, and the coronation ceremony of the Lord then started. So now, on this note, I would like to summarize and end our discussion for today, and also just briefly recapitulate one or two points. Diwali is the day when Lord Ram returns to Ayodhya. Diwali is also the day when Lord Krishna performed the Damodar Leela at Nanda Bhavan, at the residence of Nanda Baba and Mother Yashoda. When that beautiful Leela took place, that was also an expression of love, love between the Lord and his devotees. This is also an expression of love, love between the Lord and his devotees at the reunion. And this is actually, Diwali is an occasion for us to celebrate the reunion of the soul with the super soul, with the Lord. And therefore, when that happens, then there is energy is released. And that energy is expressed as happiness. And so we say, Happy Diwali. Hare Krishna. And to commemorate the coronation of Lord Ram, we are going to start our kirtan, which we do always at the end of our lecture. But first we will sing Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram. And then we will also go on to the Hare Krishna kirtan. Hare Krishna. Thank you.